Durable, so let's see.
Got off the level of the sure thing.
If we can make some progress here on Daf Chof Aleph Amid Beis. If you recall, we were able to cover the Brisa of Mai Hanukkah. I want to come back to it again, but first I want to make a little progress in the Gemara itself. So if you count up from the bottom of Daf Chof Aleph Amid Beis, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines, then you'll see a Gemara that starts right after the Brisa of Mai Hanukkah with Tnan Hasam. And this Gemara is quoting a Mishnah, of all places, a Mishnah in Bava Kama. And if you recall, we pointed out that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi does not incorporate any of the laws of Hanukkah in the Mishnayos. It's all omitted from the Mishnah. We find it in Brises, Tosefta's, in Toras Kohanim, elsewhere, but not in the Mishnah. But we do have one Mishnah in Shas that does relate to the Ner Hanukkah, but not Mitzad, not because of the mitzvah of Ner Hanukkah. Maybe we'll just close the door there. But rather, because of Ner Hanukkah as a potential mazik. Right now, we have four categories of mazikim, of damaging objects that are in your possession, and you have to be very careful to watch them and guard them to make sure that they don't damage. And that's the first Mishnah in Masechta Bava Kama. In the sixth parak of Bava Kama, the Gemara addresses the cases of Eish, which is one of the four, and other mazik, which, according to Rav, at least, is one of the four as well. So Eish means I light a fire, and I'm not careful about guarding the fire. And a wind, a normal velocity wind, comes and carries the fire, and it does damages. It burns up somebody's haystack. And that's called the mazik of Eish, and for that you have to pay damages. Adama mazik would be a case where you actually directly damage somebody. Let's say you take your, if you're a karate expert, you take a karate chop on someone's table and you break his table. And you pay damages for that. So now the Mishnah says the following. Gets. When a carpenter works with the bellows, then what happens is a spark, which is called a gets, goes flying out. The gets has the status of Eish. Why? Because as soon as it comes in contact with something flammable, everything goes up in smoke. Now, the carpenter, who's called a napach, napach nun pei chet in modern Hebrew. Napach is the person who uses a hammer or bellows in order to bang on what's called an anvil, you know, some sort of a steel or metal receptacle. As a result, yotze mitachas apatish, this spark flies out from underneath his hammer. And what happened in this case, the Mishnah describes it, yotze mehizik, and it burned someone else's object. Chayav. The napach has to pay compensation under the law of Eish. Now here, we have a fundamental machlokas between Tosfos and the Rambam. Tosfos over there, Masechta Bava Kama, assumes, as I suggested, that the reason why the napach, this carpenter, has to pay damages because of Eish. He, in a sense, has created this fire, and he's responsible to see to it that this fire would not get out of hand, out of control. And he didn't do so. And since he was negligent with regard to this fire, therefore he has to pay damages under the law of Eish. And we'll come back to this sheet of Tosfos in just a second. First I want to present to you the sheet of the Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchos Chovel U'Mazik Peravov says a different shot. He says that this Mishnah is not addressing the Mazik of Eish, but rather the Mazik of Adam. Okay. Now, offhand, who makes more sense over here? Intuitively, would you side with Tosfos and we're talking about Eish, a fire, or with the Rambam and we're talking about Adam Amazik?
Eish.
Yeah. He's not taking karate chop and breaking someone's table, right? He was in charge of an Eish. He created a fire and he didn't watch the fire. Tosis is right, l'chora. How do we understand the Rambam? Why should the Rambam classify this under the mazik of Adam? It should be a classical case of Eish. So here we have to understand the difference between what's called Adam HaMazik and Eish. Where do we define, how do we set up the boundaries between the two? So let's just see if I could find what I need to use this whiteboard. Oh, I'm halfway there. You know what? I'm not even going to look for the eraser. I'll just, if you don't tell anybody, I won't tell anybody. Okay. In order to understand the difference between Adam HaMazik and Eish, we have to know that Adam HaMazik is called Kocho. Kocho means that it's his force. Now, obviously, if he takes his arm and he breaks the table, that's his force. That's the most blatant and obvious case of Adam HaMazik. But the word Kocho and that concept indicates a much broader field. And that includes whenever he sends out some sort of a force. And if that force is coming directly from his body, that's called kocho. And if it damages, it comes under Adam HaMazik. Then we get to Eish. Eish means not a direct koach, it's not his force, but rather what's called koach acher me'uravbo. Okay? So you need another force. So now, let's go through the classical cases of Eish and Adam HaMazik, and then we have the gray area, so that's ambiguous, that might fall under either category. The classical case of Eish is Ruach, which means that I create a fire, and the wind carries the fire from the location where I created the fire to the location of the Hezek. That's called Koach Acher Me'urupo. In other words, when he lit the fire would have stayed in its place, it wouldn't have damaged. Then we have Adam HaMazik, and I said the classical example of Adam HaMazik is where he directly takes his hands or his feet and he breaks something. In the middle, we have this case of Getz Hayotze Min HaPatish. This is going to be a machlokas between the Rambam and the Rashba. What exactly went on over here? The Rashba learns that the Getz was carried by the wind. So although the force of his knock, of his banging, the carpenter's banging, the mapo, that itself created the Eish, but the Eish would not have damaged in its place. Meaning, if I shoot out a fire, it only has the ability, let's say, to reach that wall. It can't go beyond that wall. And yet it burnt up your haystack way beyond that wall. The answer is that the wind came, according to the Rashba and according to Tosfos, and brought that Getz further than my original Eish. So there's no koach in the Eish to be mazik, therefore comes under not Adam HaMazik, but rather Eish. That's the sheet of Tosfos and the Rashba. The Rambam, on the other hand, understood that this Gemara, since the Mishnah doesn't mention a word about the Ruach, then it's Getz HaYotze Mitachas HaPatish V'Yotze V'Hizik.
When you hit anything with a hammer, it gives a spark. It has nothing to do with it.
And that spark, because of the force that you put into it, will reach that goal, you know, that location and destroy it. That's called Kocho, and that's Adam HaMazik. Now, before I answer your question, Ben, I just want to throw out one question for thinking. What's the difference? My nafkimina, who cares whether you classify it as Adam HaMazik or you classify it as Eish? Just give me 1 minute. I want to answer Ben's question, and then we'll answer that question. Ben?
I'm just seem to recall a category called Koach Kocho. It's like a secondary.
Interesting. Koach Kocho is the following. Let's say there are dates on the tree, and I throw up a clump of earth, and it hits the dates, that would be kocho. If, for example, you're the owner of this date palm tree, you can sue me for damages on the date as Adam HaMazik. Now, instead of what happened, is as a result of that force, the dates fell down from the top of the tree, and they damaged something on the way down, the impact of the fall. That's called koach kocho. Now, what's the status of koach kocho? This is a major machlokas, and all the modern technological issues that come up, for example, there's something called help me out here, something switch, what's it called?
A grama switch?
Yeah, but there's an English word for it that in the secular world, you know, you call it a grama switch because you're a London, you know, but it's a, what's it called, a something switch?
It's like a dead button or something.
Yeah, anyway, it means that you move things around and then the magnet causes it to go together and it sets up an electric kind of response. Anyway, all the issues in modern technology have to do with what's called koach kocha, meaning that I set a process into motion, and then that process, in turn, sets in another process. So let's say, for example, this is a wild Gemara in Masechta Chulin, but the Gemara says this actually happened. There was a dam, and the dam was holding back the water. Now, on the other side of the dam, there was a knife. On the other side of the knife, there was an animal. Somebody comes along, removes the dam, the water floods, and carries the knife until it slaughters the animal. Is that called shechita? Shechita has to be koach adam. And when I was in the army, this question came up over and over again. We had lots of dams and lots of knives and lots of animals. I'm just kidding. What do I mean? The case used to happen all the time in the army. What we did was, we didn't have, very often, a kli for netilas yadayim. So what we would do is, we would open a beres, like we do today, and the water would fall on our hands. This is called koach kocho, because apparently what happens is, I don't know the whole mechanism of it, you know, you have to ask the engineers, but by opening the beres, it causes a kind of reaction. There's a first flow of water, and then once the first flow of water comes out, a second flow of water comes out. That second flow of water is called koach kocho. Anyway, Rabosai, since we're learning this Gemara, more or less, Asher, you wanted to say something before. Do you remember what it was? If not, we'll just go on because I really want to. I have a lot on the agenda for today. You know, I really want to get to Daf Chaf Beis. You know, we've been on Chaf Aleph for like 2 weeks almost. Yeah.
I'm just curious why the Gemara segued from talking about what is Hanukkah all about to this very, very detailed application of the laws of damaging with your Hanukkah. If we all could have talked about, why didn't you resist the segue into it?
Right. The reason for this, as we'll soon see, is because this is going to impact on the law of Ner Chanukah. What do I mean? When you light a Ner Chanukah, as we saw earlier in the sugya, you light it outside your house. And according to the Tosfos Shita, you light it in Rosh Hashanah. It's a public thoroughfare. Are you required to afford a security protection on your Ner Chanukah? Let's say, for example, somebody goes by, he's got a massive amount of merchandise. You know, those days he used to carry it on the back of camels, and his camel went by your Ner Chanukah. And it was carrying flax, and the whole flax went up in fire. So believe it or not, the Gemara is going to assume that on the one hand, a person has to watch and be careful about his Ner Chanukah. He's going to have to light it in a certain height so that it doesn't damage. But on the other hand, paradoxically, the person who's going through Rosh Hashanah, he also has an obligation to worry about not having contact with your Ner Chanukah. We're going to have to sort of work out the nitty gritty.
Why isn't this gets, you know, the isn't koach koka? I mean, he's hitting the anvil of doing this. So that's his action. It hits the fire. The fire then throws off a spark, and the spark does damage.
But it's koach.
No, the spark actually comes from the contact between his hammer and the piece of metal that he's working.
Not that he's blowing, he's using the bellows to blow the
leave
fire.
Out the bellows.
Okay.
How does he, you have an art scroll, does he translate the word gets? Does he call it a spark?
Yeah, spark.
And what does he say afterwards?
Yeah, he says it comes out from under the hammer.
Nice. Under the hammer. Yeah, so let's leave out the bellows. Maybe okay. Bellows is a little bit more more complicated.
I don't know where I got that from. I take it back.
Yeah. Okay. Although I do think, but again, I don't want to get off on a tangent, that even with bellows, you can send out a spark. I'm not sure. Okay, we'll have to ask our local.
But the bellows on the fire would be cocoa because I'm doing it.
Spark itself is fire. So if I shoot out a fire, that's called Adam Amazik. That's cocoa. If, on the other hand, that fire would catch here and then cause another fire elsewhere, that would be called kocha.
Okay.
So the Gemara says as follows. This is the Seifa of the Mishnah in Masechta Bava Kamma. Gamal That's a camel sheta'un pishnon. So this camel is carrying the weight of the entire flax on its back. And of course the gamal is going from one place to the other in the public thoroughfare. A person has a store, right? And let's say the store has an opening, and while this camel was passing by this opening, some of the flax on its back entered into the chanus, into the store. And then what happened was that the owner of this store lit his Hanukkah candles, vidolka b'nero shel chenvoni, and the ner, the chenvoni is the store owner, and the ner is the ner Hanukkah, and dolka, and what went up in smoke was the flax that came in contact with this ner. And then vidliku es habira, now the store, the plot goes thicker, because not only did the flax catch fire, but the flax, once it caught fire, it burnt up a whole house, a bayis gadol. Who's going to be chayav? Should we say that the owner of the ner is chayav? Or should we say that the owner of the gamal and in carrying the flax is going to have to pay? So again, the damages here is to a third party. So there's Reuven, there's Shimon, and there's Levi. Reuven is the store owner. He's called the Chenvani in the language of the Mishnah. Shimon is the Baal HaGamal, and Levi is the owner of a house called a Bira in the language of the Mishnah. The word Bira means like a castle, a very large palace. And Levi has to sue one of two people at this point. Who is directly responsible, and who can Levi sue for damages here? Does he sue the owner of the store who lit his candle and the candle was precarious? Or does he sue the owner of the flax, meaning the owner of the gamal, because he should have been careful that the flax on the back of the gamal would not enter into someone else's property and catch on fire? So the Mishnah establishes two opinions. First, we're going to learn the opinion of the Tanakhama. And then we're going to learn the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda, I'm just fast-forwarding for a second, and then we'll get back to the Chachamim, is going to make the following distinction. It all depends what that ner is all about. As we said before, the Baal HaChanvoni, the Baal HaChanus, had lit a candle. Was he within his rights to light that candle in such a precarious situation? Rabbi Yehuda says it depends. If it was a secular, mundane candle, what we call litzarako kamadlik, for his own purposes, there was no official halachic reason or obligation to light that candle, then he's going to be held responsible for the security of that candle, as we'll soon see. If, on the other hand, that candle was not a secular, mundane, run-of-the-mill candle at Sarko, but rather it was a ner shel mitzvah, ner shel Chanukah, then the halacha is going to exempt him from payment. We're going to have compassion. The Chachamim, on the other hand, are not focused at all on the ner initially. We'll have to figure out why, but rather they're focused on the pishton, on the actual damager, the physical object that damaged the bayis gadol was the pishton, was the flax that took flame. And the Chachamim say, that's the first opinion in this Mishnah, Baal HaGamal Chayav. When you are carrying you're leading your camel through a public thoroughfare, and you've got flax that's laden on the back of this beast of burden, you have to be very careful to make sure that flax doesn't go up in flames. And if it does go up in flames, you're responsible for immediately putting out that flame. And apparently, the Chachamim assume that there was an element here of pshia. I'll just write that word on the blackboard, because this is the key of understanding all of Nezikin, which is called pshia. How do you translate the word pshia?
Negligence.
Negligence, right? Negligence. in the fact that this vast volume, this amount of flax, was so great that it would spill over into the chanus. Meaning, if you're taking your gamal through the public thoroughfare, while it's carrying all this flax on its back, make sure that there's not so much flax that it spills over and it's going to enter into someone's chanus. So already, say the Chachamim, at this point in time, when the camel driver placed this vast amount of flax on the back of this camel, that was already a pshia. Now, a pshia itself is not enough to make you pay damages, right? But the potential is there. In other words, everything is set in motion. If, as a result of that pshia, down the line, someone is going to be damaged, and here was a whole chain of A, B, C, meaning that first the pshia happened that he put too much flax on the back of the gamal, and the gamal is now carrying flax that's just spilling over in all directions, that's number one. B, now the flax entered into the store that bought it on Rishus HaRavim, that was number two. Number three, as a result, the flax took up a flame, right? Because it came in contact with the nair. And number four, the animal continued in its way and burnt down someone's house, carrying this H. So there's a whole chagadya here, a whole train of causes that ultimately led to the damaging of the balabira. And the balabira now, according to the Chachamim, has recourse to sue the bala gamal for damages, because the bala chanus ostensibly has every right to leave a nair in his window. He doesn't have to worry about that. He realizes that the obligation of shmira to protect from damages is incumbent upon the bnei rishus harabim. The bnei rishus harabim have to distance themselves from the chanus. That's the underlying theory of the Chachamim. So premise number one is that the Bala Chanus is completely exonerated from any responsibility, because when he lights his candle, he's within his rights to light his candle. And the responsibility, according to Chachamim, for Shmiras Nezikin, for protecting against damages, is now shifted over to the Bnei Rishus HaRavim, those who travel through Rishus HaRavim. Now premise number two is that anyone who's walking through Rishus HaRavim is now held responsible not only to protect himself, that he shouldn't be damaged, and therefore distance himself from any fire that might be lit in a chanus, but moreover, he's obligated to be careful about the possibility that he might damage others. Do you follow me? There's a double responsibility. One responsibility is vis-a-vis himself, because now the pishna went up in smoke, and he can only blame himself because he wasn't careful. But number two, moreover, that pishtan that went up in smoke is not just a financial loss to the bala pishtan, but it's also a potential damager for the balabira, because that pishtan, once it goes up in smoke, is now a very dangerous mazik. Then we get to Rabbi Yehuda. Oh, wait a minute. We didn't get to the sefer of the Chachamim. Oh. So all this applies in a case where the nair is located within the bounds of the chanus. Do you follow what I mean? In other words, the Bala Chanus is completely exonerated from any guilt and any responsibility, no negligence, because where did he light the candle?
Inside his property.
Within his property. What I do in my property is perfectly okay. I don't have to worry about you entering into my property. And that's a sugya in the fourth parak of Bava Kama. For example, if I dig a ditch in my backyard and your animal enters into my domain and falls into the ditch, I'm not responsible for that. If I dig a ditch outside in the public domain, that's called bar, it's one of the four mazikin. But bar v'shuso, if I dig a bar in my backyard, who invited you to come into my backyard? Now, let's say I did invite you, then the halacha changes completely. And that's what the fourth parak of Bava Kama is all about. Here, who invited you to enter into my chanus and have your pishtan on the back of this gamal burnt to a crisp? However, the Brisa says the following: Hiniach en vanias nero mi bachutz. In event that the balach en vani, the balach chanus, the chenvani, placed his ner out in Rishus HaRabim, now he becomes responsible, and therefore Chenvani Chayav. Now this is unbelievable, because Chenvani Chayav now has two implications. Number one, he's going to have to pay damages to the owner of the Gamal for the flax that went up in smoke. And number two, and this is the big chiddush, he has to pay damages to the owner of the Bira, because as a result of the flax going up in smoke, now the Bira went up in smoke. So he has a double responsibility based on the fact that he had no rights to set up his fire unattended, unprotected, in Rishus HaRabim. And here I want to read to you a footnote in the Masifta. He says the following. He says that in this case, even the Rambam would agree that the chiyuv on the Dalach and Vani for placing his fire outside the Rishus HaRabim is not going to be Adam HaMazik, but rather Eish. Why? Because again, in the case of Getz, the Rambam insists that the Getz went flying and landed on somebody's haystack and it went up in smoke. That's called Adam HaMazik. That's called Kocho. But in this case, if I set up a fire and down the line the fire goes out of control, that's called Ish. Now let's go back to the question that I asked you before, but then I got distracted because Ben's question. What's the difference between classifying something as Ish and classifying it as Adam HaMazik? After all, at the end of the day, they're both considered mazikin, and you have to pay damages.
Maybe not as much.
Does anybody know what that's called? This is called tamun. You know, we're getting a crash course of a sect of Bava Kama here today. Tamun means the following. Let's say I own a haystack, and I take some very precious items and I hide them in the haystack, because I don't think anybody is going to look into the haystack and find it there. So that's where I found, you know, instead of owning a safe and forgetting the combination or losing the key, I don't know if any of you can relate to that, but this is my simchal yom in my life. So instead of that, I hide it in the middle of a haystack. Now you come along, light a fire, the wind carries the fire and burns down my haystack. Now I come running to Beis Din and I want to sue you for damages, not just on the haystack, which is worth 100. I want to sue you for damages on the precious jewels that I hid in the haystack, and that's worth 500 or 1500. So the law is, I have no recourse to demand compensation for that which is hidden.
Contributory negligence. In modern language, it's contributory negligence.
Okay, the only problem is that if you're going to use concepts like contributory negligence, I think you're going to get into deep trouble, because in the exact same case, in Bar and in Olam HaZikin, you have to pay damages for Tumim. So I would call it Gzeres HaKosev in Eish. The Gemara actually derives it from Sukkin. Now, if this would have been Adam HaMazik, then Adam HaMazik, there's no such thing as claiming contributory damages. So, for example, in the Rambam's frame of reference, that's the Getz reached directly, because of the force of his...
He decided to light... He was the Empire of Man. He decided to light the
Right, no, I just wanted to... Yeah, you're right, Osher. But I just wanted to take it down to the Getz case. Yeah. So in our Mishnah, the Rambam would say that you're chayav for tamun, because the Rambam understood that Getz hayotze mitach sapatish is Adam HaMazik. So if inside this, you know, this flax or whatever went up in smoke, or certainly in the case of the Bira, there were hidden things that were not visible to the naked eye on the outside, they're concealed, and that's called tamun, you would have to pay damages for that. According to the understanding of this Mishnah of Tosfos and the Rashba, that we're talking about koach acher me'urba, which means Eish is part of Fatam. So now we get to the Sefer of the Mishnah. Now notice, the Chachamim in the Sefer of the Mishnah make a blanket statement. And they say that if the Chenvani placed his candle, his fire outside, not inside, he's going to be chayav for damages. Do the Chachamim make any distinctions? What would be a classical case, when you think about it, of a person who places a candle outside his store? What would be a common case? Why would you put a candle outside your store? And from the fact that the Chachamim you know, if the Chachamim would make an exception to this rule in the case of their Hanukkah, then they should have led us on to that. They're sort of misleading us, because they make this absolute unqualified statement that if the Baal Kanfani put his fire outside his Chanus, he's going to be chayav for damages. That's where Rabbi Yehuda comes in. And Rabbi Yehuda makes this distinction. And he says that you can only hold a person, the Baal Chanus, responsible for the Eish, if it's a secular candle. But if it's a ner shel mitzvah, ner Chanukah, let's read it inside, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, b'ner Chanukah potter. He's potter for any damages. In other words, according to Rabbi Yehuda, the entire enterprise of chiyuv nezikin, of tashlumin nezikin, depends upon what's called reshus. Okay, this is, again, we're getting a very quick overview of Masechet Bava Kamma. What's reshus? Like, for example, are you allowed to take drainage, sewerage, and shove it into the public domain?
At the time of year.
Oh, excellent. So the Gemara says the following, that l'chora, if you clear out from your private property sewerage into Rishus HaRabim, you've created a bar. And if anyone goes through and trips or falls or gets dirty and soiled, you have to pay damages. That's called bar. But the Gemara makes the following distinction. There are certain months of the year where the municipality, I'm not going to mention the mayor because that'll, you know, then we're, you know, we'll probably have about 8 different opinions here of who the next mayor is going to be, right? But, you know, you always say that when you get 2 Jews together, you get 3 opinions, right? Anyway, so the municipality allows, gives permission during certain months of the year to push your sewerage out into the public domain. And that's called Bershus. What happens now is we neutralize the element of Pshia, which is the basic Machayev that generates the Chiyuv of Tashlumin Nezikin, of paying damages. And instead we have something called Rishus. And what happens now is that the responsibility to protect oneself against damages gets shifted from the owner of the Mazik, in this case the sewerage, to the Bnei Rishus Arab. And therefore, according to Rabbi Yehuda, if you're talking about Eish, we're going to apply the same yardstick. And the rules are, the rules of the game in Ezekiel are the following. Did you have a right, did you have legal permission and license to place your fire where you placed it? If the answer is no, you're going to be responsible, you're going to pay damages, that's called Pshia. If the answer is yes, you had license to place it exactly where you did, that shifts the responsibility over to the Bnei Rishus HaRab, that's called Bershus. And herein lies the distinction between a classical ner and the ner Chanukah 8 days of the year. For those 8 days, says Rabbi Yehuda, you had a reshus, you were allowed and permitted legally to put your flame outside of your chanus, that shifts the responsibility of damages or of protection against damage over to the Bnei Rishus HaRabim, and therefore your part.
I have a simple question. This Rabbi Yehuda, is this an inference from Bava Kamma?
This is part of the mission of Bava Kamma.
It's part of the mission.
Yeah. Now, let me tell you this. Don, how do you know when you learn a Gemara when you shift from a Mishnah over to the Gemara? There are 2 ways of knowing that. One way is if the Gemara quotes an Amora. Once the Gemara quotes a statement of Amora, you know that right before that quote, you finish the Mishnah, or you finish the Brisa. The other way of knowing it is when you shift from Hebrew to Aramaic. Why? Because the Mishnah was written by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in Hebrew, in Lashon Kodesh, and the Gemara was written in the vernacular in Aramaic. In this case, I know that the Mishnah completed because it says Amar Avina. Ravina was a second generation Amora, so I know that the Mishnah completed. Most cases, it's, you know, because the Gemara wasn't punctualized. You know, I don't know, the article maybe is punctuated. I don't know. It's not.
Yeah.
Okay, they have Gemaras today, Steinsaltz and all the other publications, you know, where everything I'm telling you now is totally superfluous. It's unnecessary because they punctuate it for you. I've seen mistakes, by the way. Not in Steinsaltz. I'm not. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. Steinsaltz is great, but I'm saying I've seen punctuated Gemaras that have actually made mistakes. They put the vowels in the wrong place.
Right.
But all I'm trying to say is that it's a great key to remember that as soon as you see a language shift, you know we're going from a Mishnah or a Brice on the one hand over to the Gemara on the other hand.
Follow up.
Oh, good. I just want to.
So the Bava Kamma was the exception that it actually mentions Chanukah.
The only Mishnah that mentions Chanukah is a Mishnah about what? Damages. That's all Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi can mention about Chanukah. Am I responsible for damages if my Ner Chanukah was the cause of your Pishnah going up in smoke, and then the Balat Bira comes and he says, you blew up my Bira.
With the secular candle, if there's no Ruach, but the overly laden camel passes by, is the Bashir, the owner, totally overlooked?
Wait, go slowly, David. Where is this camel?
It's outside. There's no Ruach. It's just sitting. It's a calm day.
Right.
The camel comes by overly laden, burdened with flax,
right,
more than he should have been. Is the Bashir of the owner of the camel now overlooked totally because...
No. Only in a rare case of a hurricane or something.
Yeah.
But again, in normal conditions, if I put my fire in front of my house,
right,
I violated the reshus that we spoke about. I had no license to do so, and that generates a chiyuv me to stand over the fire and, you know, protect it from all sides. I have to bring my whole family out and make a circle around the fire, if you know what I mean. Menachem?
Yeah, no, just... I would read it differently. The Mishnah, you said... in the beginning, but Nitnasa Pishtana Rotocha Chanukah Vedalka Benero Shalchin Vahida means, I would think that would mean just a normal Nair. And the Machloke is only in the Seifa.
Wait, when you say a normal Nair, you mean a secular Nair?
Yeah. Okay, because when you read it, you said Nair Chanukah.
Right, but then I sort of backtracked on that, because what I tried to do is then introduce the Seifa Rabbi Yehuda. So you're right, this
because
Mishnah.
The Seifa is only talking about Nero Shabbos.
Correct.
It's not even
the difference between the Reish and the Seifa is whether you're talking about the Ner located inside the Chanus or outside the Chanus. Up until Rabbi Yehuda, we have no distinction between a secular, you know, mundane, everyday candle and the Ner Chanukah. Rabbi Yehuda comes along and he says, Chachamim, how can you make this general statement that just simply because he put his Ner on the outside, he's responsible for the Ner and he pays damage? That's not true. You should have made the following qualification. Did he have Reshus to put his Ner outside? And if the halacha tells him that even though it's a Rosh Hashanah, put your Nair out there, that's a whole different story. The Pella here, and that's again, if we were learning this Be'iyun, we'd probably have to spend a week on this Mishnah, because why did the Chachamim deny that distinction? Why did they qualify? Anything that's unqualified until you get another Tana in the Mishnah means that it, just that. If it's unqualified, it's unqualified. It's absolute. And it seems that the Chachamim insist that even that, and this is the paradox, that on the one hand, Allah is going to tell you, put your candle outside, and on the other hand, the same Allah is going to tell you, you're required to wash your candle. That's the paradox of the Chacham. So for that, we would need a week studying this Mishnah. But what we do understand here in the context and the framework of Nezikin, why Rabbi Yehuda makes this distinction. Rabbi Yehuda says, once the Halacha tells you, A, you're allowed to put your Ner Chanukah outside, and not only that, you're required to put your Ner candle outside, at that point, the Halacha exonerates you from any Chiyuv Shmiras Nezikin, and the Chiyuv Shmiras Nezikin now shifts over to the B'nai Rosh Hashanah. Ben?
I have a question.
I see on your face you have a question. You just haven't formulated it yet. Omar Avina, Zoso Meres, Ner Chanukah Mitzvah Laniach B'toch Asara. Wow. David's not here, but if he was here, I would show him how Ravina... Oh, David, you're here. Brilliantly, look at this. Omar Ravina, because this can answer your question from before. What does this Mishnah have to do with the sugya of Chanukah, other than the fact that Rabbi Yehuda made a distinction in Ezekiel? But we're not learning Ezekiel now, we're learning the laws of Chanukah. So Ravina is going to derive from this Mishnah conclusion about where I have to put my Ner Chanukah. And he says the following. Zoso Meres, from the fact that Rabbi Yehuda makes this distinction between the secular everyday candle and the Ner Chanukah, in the case of the Ner Chanukah, you're potter for Nezikin, we must conclude that Ner Chanukah, mitzvah lanicha, besoch asara. Now, before we get, again, there are a lot of nitty-gritty details here, minutia, but just to get the general flow of the Gemara conceptually, where do you put your Ner Chanukah? Do you put it low or do you put it high? Says Ravina, if the answer would be, just arguing from the opposite position, the elimination of this possibility, if the answer that you want to suggest is put your candle high, then Rabbi Yehuda makes no sense. Why? The isal kedaitoch lemalo me'asara. If you're going to entertain the possibility that the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is to put it high up, and by the way, Rabbi Osai, what would be the compelling logic to say that the Ner Chanukah should be higher?
Publicity.
Exactly, it gets more of a public publicity. You know, that which is high, I can see from a distance. You know, who's looking all the way down at the floor? People don't walk and look at the floor. If that be the case, lemole, then the owner of the palace that went up in smoke should have the right to claim hayel chala nichala mala migamal verochbo. This is very interesting. The gamal is, it reaches a certain height. Let's throw out a number. Anybody want to throw out a number? I mean, a gamal is pretty high, but give me a number. I don't care. Whatever number you 30, pick out. 20 tefachim. Why did you place your Ner Chanukah below 20 tefachim in a way that now the gamal and its flax would catch on fire? You should have put your... placed your Ner Chanukah above 20 tefachim. Again, I'm just using 20 tefachim as a number out of my hat. If it would have been high up, then the flax would never have caught smoke, and you would have been mekayim the mitzvah. In other words, in this balancing act between the rishus, the license that Chacham are giving you, and the possibility of doing damages, Chazal would have said to you, fulfill this mitzvah in such a way that it doesn't expose, it doesn't jeopardize anyone to damages, namely lift it up higher. The answer is that the Chachamim want the Ner Chanukah lower, and you have to put it in a place... you're required to locate it in a way that the gamal going through with its flax is in danger of going up smoke. So if that be the case, says Rabbi Yehuda, since the halacha requires me to place the Ner Chanukah below that level, meaning at the eye level where the gamal and its flax will catch on fire, then Rabbi Yehuda says I'm fatur from damages, because even though I placed the candle exactly in a location which is very dangerous, I was required to do so. If there was no requirement to lower my Ner Chanukah, then the halacha would say, raise your Ner Chanukah. You're required to light a Ner Chanukah, im rishus harabim, but raise it up high. So let's see it inside. The isal kedaitoch lemala me'asara. If the halacha would require that you place your Ner Chanukah higher than 10, again, we don't know what 10 is, we'll call 10 tefachim, let's call 10 tefachim, is lemole, let the nizak means the owner of the palace, claim, hayel chala nichala mala mi gamal v'rochbo. You should have fulfilled your mitzvah properly, placed it on a high level, and it would have been, on the one end, a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, at the same time, a fulfillment of your chiyuv shmiras nezikin. But since you lowered it, that's called a pshia. And within the context of the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, by lowering it, you have violated your chiyuv, your obligation to protect of nezikin, to make sure that no one gets damaged. And Rabbi Yehuda on the other hand says that the chinvari, the owner of the store, is potter. Why is he potter? Says Ravina, must be logically that the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah requires that you put it besoch hasara, lower than 10 tefachim. And as a result, the balabira, says Rabbi Yehuda, has no right to claim you were a posher, you were negligent, because you were within your rights, you were berushos, to place your Ner Chanukah exactly at that level.
Why did the Chachamim require it to be below the 10 tefachim? Oh, why not higher?
Excellent. It seems that 10 tefachim is always, and this we have to take out a different part of Masechta Shabbos. It's so funny that we're learning Masechta Shabbos. We haven't mentioned a word about Shabbos lately, you know. Again, we did touch on the Neros and the Shmarim, that apostle for Shabbos, but that was just the background. We've really been learning Masechta Chanukah.
Has to do with Rishut Rabbim versus Rishut Rabbim versus
Correct. The halacha is, again, this is very, very complicated, but just to give you the tip of the iceberg, Rishus HaYochid, a private domain, is Ola Adler Akia. there's no limit to its height. It goes up to the wherever the, I don't know, what's the highest point that the astronauts ever reached? The moon, I guess? Have they gone beyond that distance yet? No. So it goes up all the way to the moon. Now, that's based on a very profound halacha called God Asik Mechitzis, meaning a Rishus HaYochid is something that is surrounded by walls, by mechitzos. Perhaps the most complicated word or concept in all Shas is mechitza. And I'm telling you, Rabosa, you could probably spend your life trying to define a mechitza, and you would not waste your time. Rab Chaim Brisker in his Sefer on the Rambam has tons of pages, and his son Rab Moshe also, tons of pages trying to define a mechitza. A mechitza is the most abstract concept in halacha. And basically, once I set up a mechitza, the mechitza halachically is considered that it goes endlessly above. Now, since that definition of a private domain of Rishus HaYochid is mukaf mechitzos, then that area, and it matters not what the size of that area, is always by definition going to be considered mukaf mechitzos. And therefore, Rishus HaYochid goes up to Shaman. Rishus HaRab is a whole different story. It is derived from Mishkan, very complicated. But anyway, Rishus HaRabim is only ole up until 10 tefachim. That's where the Rishus HaRabim terminates. Anything above that is what's called a makom p'tur. So can you imagine if on Shabbos I throw something through Rishus HaRabim above 10 tefachim? That means it's flying through a makom p'tur. Okay then? And that's you know, one of the, again, we summarized all of Masechta Bava Kamma. I'm not expecting to summarize all of Melechus Hotzah. In fact, tonight, you know, there's supposed to be a Siyum on Masechta Shabbos, so they're giving me the opportunity to say a few words in order to clinch the Siyum. So I'm going to speak about Melechus Hotzah a little bit, you know, for they give me 5 minutes. I'm going to probably take a sixth minute. But anyway, don't tell the organizers, you know, and keep it secret. Anyway, Melechus Hotzah is very complicated, but we want to say the following, that Rishus HaRabim is Ola Ad Asar Tefachim. Above Asar Tefachim, it's not Rishus HaRabim. If that be the case, then granted the position of Tosis, if you remember, that the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is, bless you, is Rishus HaRabim, so therefore the Chachamim want it to be in Rishus HaRabim. They want the candle to be lit in Ner Chanukah in Rishus HaRabim, which means it's got to be lower than 10 Tefachim. Now, so you and I would say intuitively, well, let's raise it higher. And Ravina does have such a Havamin, but he says, if you accept that Havamin, that the higher it is, the more piercing it is, and therefore the greater mitzvah, then we have a right in the Zikin to hold him responsible for lowering it down to the level where the Bala Gamal with his Pishtar is going to catch fire. But because the Halacha requires you to place it in that low level, therefore Rabbi Yehuda says, you're Birshus, and as we said before, the Chiyuv Shmira now shifts over to the B'nai Rishus HaRab. Means that if you're going through Rishus HaRab on Leil Chanukah, and again in the winter months that's pretty early on the clock, and you haven't closed shop, here in Eretz Yisrael it could be as early as 4, 4:30, you know, they're going to change the clock soon. So it's 4:30 in the afternoon, again it's getting dark out because it's the winter of Chanukah. And you have to know that wherever you go in Rishus HaRabim, you're going to be, if you're in the periphery of Rishus HaRabim, you're going to have contact with many, many Neros Chanukah. You know, Reuven's Ner Chanukah and Shimon's Ner Chanukah. Better take precaution. And if you don't take precaution, you become responsible. Yes, Steve?
So is there a limitation in front of the store as to where you can place it into the Rishus HaRabim?
Yeah, it's got to be
in the middle of the street.
Yeah, it's got to be, I think if I remember correctly, we didn't get to that yet, up to three tefachim, because it's that's another concept in mechitzos called lavut. Lavut means if two things are very close to each other. Now, on the one hand, we want the ner to be out there in Rishus HaRabim, but on the other hand, it's got to be pesach beso. It's got to be connected to his bias. Because the entire enterprise of Ner Chanukah is a bias enterprise, Ner Ishu Besa. So if I understand you correctly, your question correctly, the Ner Chanukah has to be below 10 Tefachim, it has to be within 3 Tefachim of the Pesach Beso. Does that answer your question? But we need one more line to complete the sugya. So the Gemara says, V'dilma, how does Ravina know this? I'm going to play the devil's advocate. The Dilma, maybe there's no mitzvah to put the Ner Chanukah below 10 Tefachim. If you'll ask me, why then does Rabbi Yehuda say that in the case of Ner Chanukah you're exonerated from any response, any damages? And the answer is, imitricha le'tuva asi le'imnu'e mi mitzvah. In other words, it's very complicated, and it's a very heavy burden to carry. That's called mitricha in Yoshin. Tircha is a heavy burden. Sometimes the chachamim have an ideal mitzvah, the way they'd love to, but then they realize that there's such a tircha here, we're asking a person too much. So imagine if the halacha would require you, on the one hand, to place your Ner Chanukah outside your bayis, but on the other hand, to place your Ner Chanukah very high up. You know, you're going to have to maybe build a little ledge outside. I don't know exactly how you would orchestrate this. So that's called a tircha. So the Gemara says the following. Ravina, you have no proof. It could be that the halacha would absolutely advocate and be very excited if you would put your Ner Chanukah above ten tefach. I mean, it's not a din of Rishus HaRabim in the classical halacha of Hotzah. Forget about Hilchus Hotzah. But the reason why he's not responsible for damages is because even though he would fulfill the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah above 10 tefachim, we cannot impose upon him the responsibility and the obligation to place his Ner Chanukah above 10 tefachim. Let's read it inside. V'dilma, perhaps there's no mitzvah that limits you in Ner Chanukah. Dafka below 10 tefachim. You'll ask me then, why doesn't the Balabir have right to say the Chanvani? Why don't you lift up your candle above the level of the driver and his flax? And the answer is, imitricha le'tuva. You know what's going to happen if the halacha is going to require that the Ner Chanukah be placed above ten tefach? He's allowed to do so, but we can't require it, as Ravina says. Ravina says we're going to require him to lower the Ner Chanukah. No. He could fulfill his mitzvah above ten tefach. And Ravina is incorrect. He has no right to derive any conclusions from this Mishnah. You'll ask me now, since he could fulfill the mitzvah above ten tefachim, why don't we require him to place the Ner Chanukah above ten tefachim and satisfy the juggling act, the balancing with the B'nai Rishus HaRabim and their possible damages? The answer is we're not going to require that. Because within the context of the mitzvah, we may lose our customs. What I mean to say is, if it's such a tircha to require him to lift the Ner Chanukah, again, if he does it on his own, tov olav bracha. We'll give him shishi on Shabbos in the Beis HaKnesses, because not only did he fulfill the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah by raising his ner above ten tefachim, he also went overboard and beyond the letter of the law in protecting the Rishus HaRabim from damages. So I'm going to give him a great yashikah. But if the halacha would absolutely require a person to place his Ner Chanukah above ten tefachim for the benefit of the B'nai Rishus HaRabim to protect him from damages, at the end of the day, the Gemara says, Asi le'imnu'e mi mitzvah. When you make a mitzvah too complicated, at the end of the day, it's going to fall into oblivion. It's going to just be too much of a tircha, and you know what? People are going to just drop it entirely. I have a suspicion, by the way, this is a side comment, that really, technically, the mitzvah of davening in the morning is netz, is davening at sunrise. But if you look in halacha, it's a little ambiguous. Some of the language is mitzvah min hamuvchar. You know, that's only a heder mitzvah. Why didn't the halacha require that you daven with netz? The Gemara has a whole section in Masechta Brachos deriving Yeruchim Shemesh to daven at netz. And I think it's because of this very reason. If you're going to say to a person, the only way you can fulfill the mitzvah of Shacharis is if he, you know those clocks that they have that measure like 1/10 of a second, you know, then at the end of the day, he's not going to daven at all. It's just not worth his tircha. It's too much for him. So it's funny, it's interesting, that the Chazal are very practical, very realistic. They are balancing the ideal mitzvah together with not losing the amukah because of overimposing the mitzvah on them. And here's an example from Ner Chanukah according to the Gemara's dechia, the Gemara's rejection of Ravina's proof. Really, you can lift up your Ner Chanukah above ten tefach. And if you did so, we'll give you a grace yashikah, we'll stand there and we'll applaud. But the Chazal couldn't have built that in. as an absolute requirement, even though it's for the sake of the B'nai Rosh Hashanah. They would rather shift the responsibility over to the B'nai Rosh Hashanah Rabbim and loosen the requirement here and say, you know what? If you like, put your nair in a precarious place below Asar Tefachim, in the eye view of the flax and the camel driver. Why? Because otherwise we may forfeit the whole enterprise. It's going to go down the tubes. People are going to say, that's too much to ask. Find a way, you know, hire an engineer to get your Ner Hanukkah above 10 Tefachim. Where is it? Hanging in midair? So if you have a little stool, I don't know exactly where you guys light Ner Hanukkah, we have at home a little stool, and we put something, you know, to protect it. You know, don't put a Ner Hanukkah on one of these plastic chairs, what are they called, the Keter chairs? Or, you know, I know someone who did that, I don't want to tell you who it is, because that would be self-incrimination. But anyway, I know someone who actually put his Ner Hanukkah on one of these Keter chairs on the night of Hanukkah. I'm not going to tell you what happened. That's why Ner Hanukkah is a very tricky mitzvah. It's a very dangerous mitzvah. Yeah.
Actually,
no. The chair? Yeah. It Mamish did. But if it melted the chair, that's nothing. These chairs are buckets. They cost nothing. But what happened when the chair started? Yes. That part of the story I'm not going to tell. Because you might guess who did this stupid thing.
It's in the Gemara, what happened. It should be more than 3 fucking high, though.
Well, let me ask you this. How high is high? You know, today we live in apartment buildings, right? And we live in, you know, and it's
on the ground.
Does anybody know what's the highest level? That's going to be the next sugi we pick up. Just test it.
20 hours. They put 100 meters in Rishon LeZion, not just in Tel Aviv, they already have, but in Rishon LeZion.
Right, so the poskim have to find out a way of justifying that. But in the pure abstract halacha, that would be way too high for the mitzvah of Ner Hanukkah. So again, you know, the post can deal with the fact that there are other, you know, the buildings that are on the same level, so we can call it like ground level even if it's on the 30th floor up. But leave out the poskim for a minute. In pure ideal halacha, if from the ground up until your Ner Hanukkah is 20 amos, then you forfeit the mitzvah of Ner Hanukkah. And that's derived, anybody know from where? A different mesechta? Exactly. From Sukkah. And Erevin as well, but Sukkah primarily, because the Mishnah at the beginning of Masechta Sukkah, the first Mishnah, says that if you put your schach above 20 amos, then you're not yotzei the mitzvah of Sukkah. I just want to spend a few minutes here on a footnote that I found pretty interesting here in the Masifta. He says the following: Harifa Harambam Hishmitu Divrei Ravina, namely Mitzvah Lanicha Lamata Me'asara. Unbelievable! The Gedolei HaPoskim, the Rif and the Rambam, completely omit this halacha, which we'll see in Shulchan Aruch in a minute, that you must put your Ner Hanukkah below 10 Tefachim, as Ravina said. And the reason for it is Kevan Sherayaso Nidchasa. Since the Gemara works overtime to reject the proof of Ravina, it must be that the Gemara never accepted Ravina, and there's no requirement to put your Ner Hanukkah below 10 Tefachim. Amnon, however, Harbe Rishonim, he quotes Rabbeinu Chananel, the Rashba, the Rush, and others, Pasku ki Ravina, and that's how it's Paskin in Shulchan Aruch, that we should put our Ner Hanukkah below, but not above 10 Tefachim. Interesting. This gives us a methodology in how to learn halacha. According to all these Rishonim, except the Rif and the Rambam, since the Gemara rejects a proof with the word vidilma, the Gemara is just being argumentative and saying that your raya, your proof, Ravina, is not ironclad. I can interpret the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda, even if I insist that the halacha allows you with the flexibility of placing your nair above 10 tefachim. Correct? So at this point, the Gemara rejects the proof of Ravina. However, Ravina himself understood that Rabbi Yehuda was requiring you to put your nair Hanukkah, otherwise why would you be potter from damages below 10 tefachim? So it comes out like this. Ein safek motzi midei vadai. When we have a vadai, and it's definite, Ravina definitely, without cringing, without hesitating, committed himself to the position that you must place your Ner Hanukkah below 10 Tefachim. That's how he learned Pshat in the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda. The Gemara only says that you don't have to learn that pshat in the Mishnah Rabbi Yehuda. Vidilma. Do you see that word vidilma? Vidilma means perhaps. Perhaps does not have the power to undermine a definite statement, an absolute commitment of Ravina, of one of the Amoraim. And therefore, the rule of thumb is that we pass them like a vadai, even if the Gemara doesn't accept the raya. And that's called Ein Sofik Motzim Midei Vada. And therefore, in Shulchan Aruch, we paskin that the mitzvah is La Nicha L'mata Me'asof. However, here's where it's very fascinating. Because the Mechaber sort of dances at both weddings over here, and he says the following. L'chatchila mitzvah La Nicha Mitachas L'asof. Ravina seems to assume that the requirement of under Asar Tfachin is critical. It's an absolute requirement, unconditional. The Shulchan Aruch, on the one hand, accepts Ravina. And if you ask the Shulchan Aruch, where should I put Me'an Yachamim, he's definitely going to advocate placing it below 10 Tfachim. But he's going to insist that if you didn't do so, and you lifted your Ne'achanik above 10 Tfachim, you yotze the mitzvah. Where does the Shulchan Aruch fit into place? And here there are two ways to go. One way is to say that he understood the Ravina was only telling you what we would recommend, but it wasn't absolutely critically kuva. And therefore Ravina says that since within the context of Ner Chanukah, we recommend that you put the Ner Chanukah below 10 Tfachim, hence we exonerate you from damages, meaning that the reason why Rabbi Yehuda says you don't pay damages in the case of Ner Chanukah Shehizik is because he has a right, he has license and reshus to put his Ner Chanukah in the most desirable, ideal place, which is below 10 Tfachim. That's one way of learning the Shulchan Aruch, or the other way of learning the Shulchan Aruch is that since the Gemara throws in Vidilma, then the Shulchan Aruch says we have the Rif and the Rambam to rely on, and they completely omit the requirement of below 10 Tfachim. So now we have to compromise here. We have a bunch of Rishonim who came 3 and 4 centuries before the Mechaber, and they said, you know what, you must put your Ner Chanukah below 10 Tfachim. On the other end of the spectrum, we have the great poskim, the Rif and the Rambam, who say that there's no requirement whatsoever below 10 Tfachim. There's no difference between below 10 Tfachim all the way up to 20 hours. So the Shulchan Aruch found a compromise. And he said the following. On the one hand, we're going to be very impressed by the Rishonim, this bulk of Rishonim, the who's who in Rishonim that say that the Ner Chanukah should be below 10 Tfachim. On the other hand, we're not going to exclude the possibility of raising your Ner Chanukah above 10 Tfachim out of deference to the Rif and the Rambam who maintain that it doesn't matter where you put the Ner Chanukah. And if you'll allow me, we're about to end, just to read the next line in the Gemara so that we could say we're on Daf Chav Beis of it. This is just a psychological thing. Amar Rav Kahana, Dorash Rabbi Nosson Bar Maniomi, Mishmei de Rabbi Tankum. And here we turn to Daf Chav Beis of an Aleph. Ner Shel Chanukah, Sheinicha Lamala Mi Esrim Amo, Psula, above 20 Amos. You did not fulfill your mitzvah Ner Chanukah. So Mitzvah Shem tomorrow, we'll try to figure out how the Gemara makes this analogy
Sunday
to Sukkah and to Erevin, to Lechi and Korah, and comes to the conclusion that the highest level of the Ner Chanukah is up to 20 hours. So I want to take this opportunity to ask you for a favor for me, and at the same time to wish you a great Shabbos. So the favor I want to ask is if somebody could remind me, or even could do this for me, and bring on Sunday the Torah Tmima on Sefer Bereishis. We have it here on the shelves. But I know myself, and I know I'm going to forget. And the Torah Tmima has a brilliant insight into this Gemara that we're about to learn about 20 hours. The Gemara is going to derive it from Yosef, who was thrown into a pit, and how deep was the pit below ground level, etc., etc. He has a brilliant insight. So that's called the Torah Tmima. His name is Rav Epstein. And he was the son of the Aruch HaShulchan, if you ever heard of the Aruch HaShulchan, the great Aruch HaShulchan. And the second thing I want to say to you is I thank you all for a great week of learning. I'm beginning to put the pieces together of Chanukah. I never really got a chance to learn Chanukah in my life, thoroughly, from cover to cover. In fact, a crazy idea crossed my mind this morning after davening. I thought maybe I would write a book on Chanukah, because I'm so taken by these sugyos, and I think I have something to add, to contribute. I would love to write a book. Is it going to happen? Don't hold your breath. It's not going to happen. That I can promise. But in my mind, this is about the 40th book I've authored in my mind. How many books have I actually authored? Zero. But that's the way life goes.
5,000 shurim.
Okay, that's, yeah, if somebody would take the time and listen to those shurim, you know, that would be my Scott. So everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos Parshas Vayera. And if anyone's interested in learning a little Chumash today, we'll talk about the Chesed of Avram, and that's going to be at 10:40 a.m. Okay then? Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.